Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and Caroline's on a break and won't be with us today. Our guest today is a poet and a teacher. His name is Diego Baez. He is the author of Yawarate White.
Mm-hmm.
Got it close, maybe from the University of Arizona Press, a finalist for the Georgia Poetry Prize, and a semi-finalist for the Berkshire Prize for Poetry. He is a fellow at Canto Mundo, the Surge Institute, and the Poetry Foundation's Incubator for Community-Engaged Poets. Has also served on the boards of the National Book Critics Circle and several other institutions. He lives in Chicago and teaches at the City Colleges. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Diego.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Now, this book of poems is in English, Spanish, and a language that I've never heard of before, which Guarani?
Guarani, but yeah.
Guarani, okay, Guarani, which is an indigenous language of Paraguay. And is that how I'm even supposed to say Paraguay, or is that actually got a better pronunciation?
Well, it's funny. You know, I grew up pronouncing it Paraguay, but learned from other Spanish speakers in college and then in grad school, maybe a more authentic pronunciation, Paraguay. So either one.
Okay. Yeah. And your father is from Paraguay,
yeah,
or Paraguay. Yeah. Maybe we'll just stick with Paraguay for today. But you were born and raised here in the United States, in Illinois?
I was, yes. Yeah. Bloomington Normal in central Illinois.
And I think I saw somewhere that you're like this is the first book of poetry published by a Paraguayan American in English. Is that true?
Yeah, it's an honor for sure. And I will say, I hadn't really thought about that until I read the introduction that Rigoberto Gonzalez wrote, and it kind of took me aback. And it's an accomplishment for sure, and it is a question. You know, I'm certainly not the only one writing, but so far, yeah, I guess one of the first in a way.
Well, this introduction, it starts out, it's very interesting. It says, the poem, a comprehensive list of famous fictional Paraguayans, offers two entry points. It's an indictment of the ways Paraguay has been misused to serve the needs or agendas of others, usually outsiders. And in a way, it's basically also saying maybe Paraguay hasn't gotten the attention that it deserves. And the people of Paraguay. And you have several poems in here that sort of point that out. One of them very short, the football poem.
Yes. Originally, there were more. I think I had written three or four football poems, but then realized that one that made it into the final cut was the only one that really had much to say. So,
and it says it in very short. Can you read that for us?
Absolutely.
It doesn't take long.
No, it is. It occurs in the second section of the book, after I sort of try to walk readers through an experience similar to one that I remember and relive whenever I visit Paraguay. And the second section is trying to kind of settle into deeper themes of language and sort of international thinking and action. So the football poem occurs sort of in that realm. So it's called Football Poem. It's three little lines. Paraguay never got its hand of God moment. No Diego Maradona punching his way into the annals. Not a single infamous history in its sporting history.
And tell us a little bit about the history of Paraguay and where it is and what it is in relationship to the rest of South America.
Yeah, so Paraguay has a very interesting history in that Before it was the country of Paraguay, many, many different indigenous and native peoples inhabited those lands, and then the lands that became Brazil and Argentina, and even Bolivia as well. And when the conquistadors came over, the Spanish and the Portuguese actually, especially, they made it inland as far as Asuncion, the capital city, which is kind of in the middle of the country. And to the west of the of Asuncion is a part of land called the Chaco, which is sort of just these plains, forested plains for miles and miles and miles, acres and acres and acres, and difficult terrain to navigate. And so once Asuncion was established, there wasn't much excursion further west. But, you know, the native peoples were subject to enslavement and forced labor and eradication. And it set an unfortunate, I think, momentum for future exploits. And so as the Jesuits moved in, as Franciscans moved in and sought to not so much actually just convert the native peoples, but rather to really assimilate them. It was kind of a bi-directional assimilation. The priests ended up codifying Guarani, the language that we mentioned earlier. And it's one of the reasons why Guarani sort of attained the status as recognized by the nation state, whereas, you know, there are at least a dozen other indigenous languages and peoples in now what is the country of Paraguay, but their languages are not, you know, they were not remembered in the same ways. They were not memorialized. They were not used to administer the state that subjugated so many of these native peoples. And I mean, so that's one sort of era, which then really produced after revolutionary independence, the nation of Paraguay just really, I want to say, suffered slash produced slash experienced dictator after dictator and war after war. And that really only ended relatively recently. You know, my father came to this country when he was 17, I believe, in 1973. And the last and latest dictator, Alfredo Stroessner, he wasn't deposed from power until the 80s. And so I think I want to say it was the year I was born or a couple years after I was born, the last dictator of Paraguay. And he wasn't killed. He was just deposed. He moved out of the country. And but I try to capture some of that history without making it a history book.
Right. And you do. And it made me very curious to learn more about the history. And I didn't see the notes at the end of the book until I was finished reading all the poems. And I wish I had looked at those earlier, because it would have given me a greater understanding, I think, because you give a few more hints of what you're referring to in the notes. So I'm just going to, you know, tell anybody else who's looking at this, you might want to check out the notes as you're going through and gives a little background.
I'm glad you like spent some time with them, because I worried some of what ended up in the notes, I kind of wanted to treat it as an extension of the poetry, but giving myself the liberty to make it a little more just factual while still trying to make it a little interesting. And there are certain notes where I read it back and I think, oh man, this kind of should have lived as a poem itself, but it is
now. So does Paraguay have a literary history that more of us should know about?
I mean, I will say yes. And it's an incredibly rich history and complicated. We've got poets and novelists. And I've been doing, in the last couple months, I've been doing a lot of excavating of my own, because I am not particularly familiar with it. You know, my Spanish is passable in conversation. I can probably get by. It's something I am continuing to work on. My Guarani is, I know words and phrases in Guarani, and it's an incredibly interesting language, and I like to use it when I can, but I cannot have a conversation in Guarani, which is just to say that many of the, you know, Paraguayan writers, they're writing in Spanish and in Guarani. And thankfully, it has been, especially in the last 5, 6, 7 years, more translations of Paraguayan writers. Elisa Tabor did a wonderful series for Words Without Borders back in 2018, I think it was, or maybe even 2020, where they had a bunch of translators work with Paraguayan writers. So there's an excerpt from a novel, there's individual poems, and there are folks who I don't have access to by myself. I have to rely on the translators to bring into English translation. And I hope, my book is just one book, but I am hopeful to use whatever attention it gets to elevate a platform where these hopefully more Paraguayaners will be translated more broadly, and more folks, even like myself, can enjoy and read the work.
Now, is the language of Guarani, is it kind of a musical language?
So I would describe it that way, only because I have such strong associations with the sounds and the emotional just memories. It sounds so much different to English or Spanish because it's not related in any way. And so I have strong memories of, we would go when I was a child, I have two younger brothers and, my parents, and we'd all go for about a month every 3 or 4 years. We'd go during the winter, sort of the winter break between school, but we'd go for a month because, and I understand why at the time as a kid, it felt like forever, but now I'm older and I have a child myself. And I can't, first of all, can't imagine doing that journey with one child, let alone three. And my brother and I were very close in age. And so it made sense why we'd go for so long. Cause it's like, we're going to pack up and just move there for a month and then move back. And so I have such strong memories of, especially at night, cause this would have been the middle of winter in central Illinois. We then go down to South America and it's the middle of summer, which was wonderful. And we'd sit outside and talk. I mean, the adults would talk and we would just kind of sit and play with our cousins, our primos. But they would have these conversations in Guarani and then they mix in the Spanish sort of. It's sort of like Paraguayan Spanglish where they mix Spanish and Guarani. They call it Jopara. And just have these conversations. And I never knew what they were talking about. But because of the body language and the laughter and certain expressive, expressions, you get a feel for, you kind of tell what the tenor of the conversation is. And so I have such positive associations with so many of these conversations, even though I didn't understand them literally, there was a real emotional resonance that I was very much a part of the experience, even if I couldn't speak the language. And so I couldn't tell you what they were talking about, but I know that it was a joke, or I know it was a funny story, or I know that it was fun with somebody else. So,
why, when you started writing poems, did you choose to mix languages within a poem?
Yeah, that didn't, I didn't at first. It took me a while to become comfortable writing in anything other than English. I mean, it really wasn't until, I do recall quite well, a senior seminar course during undergraduate at Illinois Wesleyan, I started to experiment with mixing some Spanish words and phrases into sort of memory poems about Paraguay. And it felt natural, it felt comfortable, but it wasn't until I spent a lot more time just really actually just looking at, just visually looking at Guarani. It's an interesting language visually because there's like these compounds of consonants and all kinds of diacritics that we don't have certainly in English and not even in Spanish. And from that place of curiosity, I wanted to learn more about, well, how are these words working and how do they correspond with whatever minimal language I do have at my own disposal. Like, for example, I have great memories of every time we'd show up at like a tío's house, or our tíos would come over to the farm when we were visiting in Paraguay, everyone would say, "Bae shepa," and that's how we would greet each other, "Bae shepa." And as a kid growing up, I was interested in language and I was a good speller. But "Bae shepa," okay, obviously it starts with a B. No, it doesn't start with a B. It starts with M-B-E apostrophe. And I'm like, that's fascinating. That's not what I would have expected as an English speaker. And so it really wasn't until these poems kind of started to coalesce into the book that it is today, and that took a long time, that I got more adventurous. And I really had to reckon with the question of, what is mine to use? What is mine to share? I don't speak these languages, but my family does. My father does. I grew up with it in the house. And so I try to be careful and explore sort of where that line is or where the boundary is between, you know, just scraping the internet for words and phrases I can toss into poems versus what actually resonates authentically with my own experience. Mm.
Yeah. Why did you not learn the languages growing up if your father was speaking them?
Yeah, well, if you ask me and my brothers, it's because my dad just didn't teach us. If you ask my dad, he will tell you. He will tell you. Because I asked that same question. Because years and years ago, when I was in college, I was pretty salty about that, about not being bilingual. And my dad just told me to my face, he was like, well, you didn't want to. So I was like 5 or 6 or whatever. And so, immigrant parents, they have their reasons and complicated reasons and complex reasons for what they teach and what they don't. Yeah. I think in many families, it's a safety or security mechanism to assimilate, to become part of, you know, the population here in the States. I don't think that was the case for my dad. We haven't talked a whole lot about it, but through some conversations, I'm beginning to see that it was something he was experiencing that I have a wider aperture on now, which is coming to this country from South America, from one of the smallest countries in South America, joining an immigrant population that is the smallest in the U.S. There's only, I think I saw census data from the most recent census, there's about 28,000 Paraguayans or Paraguayan Americans now in the U.S. That's not very many. That's very small.
That's a small town.
Exactly. That's right. Across the whole country. And so for him to come to this country and not really have a Spanish speaking community until I think later, I think he now I make jokes with him that he knows all the Paraguayans in Illinois, Wisconsin, and Missouri. But we did not have that growing up. We did not have a Spanish speaking community. And so I think the only reason I can really appreciate that now is that I find myself in a similar situation, although exacerbated by not really having command of the language myself. I have a child, I have a daughter who's 4 and a half now, and we use some Guarani words and phrases. She understands a good amount of Spanish, but we don't have that many opportunities to practice. I have to go out of my way to immerse her in the language. And I wonder if my dad had similar challenges.
Mm, yeah. And like you said, it's a lot of times the kids don't want to learn because they don't want to be different than everybody else, than all the other kids.
Yeah, absolutely right. And my daughter she's pretty good. I know she understands because she responds. She'll respond in English, but sometimes she will just say it in English. Right. I'm not going to push because then you're not going to like it.
So. Yeah. But, you know, as an adult, you think, oh, what an advantage that would have been to have grown up bilingual.
Yeah. And I hope to at least instill the, because like you mentioned, grew up with these languages in the household, especially on the phone. So I grew up very much in an era of landlines. And so my dad would use the landline at least once a week. It was maybe usually Sundays, it felt like, maybe Sunday nights. He'd call and talk for what felt like a long time, very loudly, because the connection was always so bad. So he's like shouting in Spanish and Guarani. Not angry shouts, just a lot of volume. But I still have such positive associations with those languages, right? Like this book doesn't get written without that background, the ambient Spanish, the ambient Guarani. And so with my child, I try to just speak in Spanish when I can. And we used to have, they're all offline now. We used to have those, a couple of those smart speakers where you can just ask them questions like, what is so-and-so in Spanish?
Right.
Decent. Yeah, they're not going to teach you how to talk like anyone in particular, but they'll help. That was actually surprisingly useful because I found myself at a loss quite frequently. And when the internet knows, it can at least kind of, it's like a stand-in for us.
Right. Yep. Now, Diego, did you always want to be a poet?
Probably. I knew I liked words. And I wrote about this recently for something, but I should have known this at the time. When I was in like kindergarten or first grade, My mom's father, so my maternal grandfather, had like a, what would have been one of the first home computers, like one of the first personal computers, and there was a spelling game on there, and it had some, you know, very rudimentary graphics, but one of the words was archaeologist. And I remember being in, I mean, it must have been first grade. I don't think it could have been kindergarten, but in first grade, hearing archaeologist and just loving the vowels that were like strung together. And I loved spelling the word archaeologist. And I was, for a little while, convinced I should be a paleontologist or someone who dug up dinosaur bones.
Of course. Didn't we all?
Like, right? It's so exciting. How can you not? But in reality, what I realize in retrospect is it was the word itself is what was more interesting to me.
Okay, than... I have a great story about that. So yeah. I have a grandson. He's a teenager now. But one of his very first words that he ever said was Brachiosaurus. I would read him these dinosaur books. He was fascinated by dinosaurs. He's 2 years old, you know, barely two. And he pointed to one. He goes, and he says, I mean, he could maybe say mom, dad, water, you know, just a very limited vocabulary. And he says, Brachiosaurus.
It's so funny what sticks in the little one's mind.
Oh, like, yeah. Of course, I'm old enough that that we were taught it was a brontosaurus, which turns out didn't exist. And but one of my clearest memories of childhood is from second grade making a paper mache brontosaurus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Turns out we were taught lies. Pluto's a planet, lies.
Yeah, right. Yep. So when you went to college, you studied poetry, you studied writing, literature, and what do you teach?
Yeah, so when I share this story with my students because I think it's helpful for them. I think it would have been helpful for me to learn a little bit more about how my faculty came to where they are. I think that's more common now, but at the time, there was just like none of that. It was just, you're the professors, you know everything, like, you know, teach us. So in undergrad, I wanted to study English, philosophy, and religion. And so I took a bunch of courses in all of those areas. By the time it came graduation, I, you know, got to reckon with my transcripts. And the truth was I was going to major in English and that's it. But so I then decided to go to poetry school at Rutgers in Newark, and now I teach English, so English composition, basically every level I've taught at the City Colleges. And for anyone unfamiliar, the City Colleges is just a system of 7 community colleges here in Chicago. They're open access. Literally anybody can enroll. And I think that's a very beautiful thing. We get students from literally all over the world. I just saw on our website, I was looking at this yesterday for some reason, Truman College is home to students who speak over 90 languages. Now over 90 different languages are spoken in the halls, which is wild. And, you know, we were talking about bilingualism earlier. I mean, many of these students are bilingual, trilingual, quadrilingual, and then they're learning English, which is incredible.
I know. And there are people here who will criticize someone for not being completely fluent in English when they may know 4 other languages, whereas the person doing the criticizing doesn't know any other languages.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
And what I am seeing in the classrooms are not just myself, but some of my colleagues, we're trying to flip that so that we see those other languages that students have. This just happened today. What did a student say? Oh, yeah. I was going as my English 102 course is it's like a research writing course. I was responding to a student's question about semicolons, which, as we all know, notoriously tricky. You can really mess them up. In most cases, you don't need to use them. But when you can use them, they can be very, you know, beautifully effective. And that's more or less what I said. And then a student chimed in to say that in her language, she's Ukrainian, in her language, semicolons are used for other purposes and they're used to just different forms of expression. And I said, that's super interesting. I wonder if what we can learn as English language writers, what we can learn from Ukrainian with regard to semicolons, because I don't see a reason to not like use that, you know, not incorporate that. It seems like such a an important potential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. You're listening to Writers Voices, and our guest today is Diego Baez, and he is the author of Yawarwate White, or something close to that. I'm going to have him say the name of it so we get it exactly right. It is...
Yawarwate White.
Yawarwate White. And Yawarwate is jaguar?
Mm-hmm. Yep. It is the Guarani word for commonly jaguar or like tiger. And it's an interesting word because it sort of looks like jaguar. You can kind of see it in there.
Mm-hmm.
But the ete at the end is a suffix that means real or true. And so I was fascinated by that, like what that meant, because the book is interested in questions of authenticity and sincerity and identity, to have a word that looks kind of similar like the one we use in English, but yet when it's appended with the suffix and you change the J to a Y, you throw in an accent, all of a sudden it's very, it's very different, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I assume that jaguars do live in Paraguay?
So this is an interesting thing. I mean, they used, like in most other parts of the world, they used to be much more common. They certainly do still, not anywhere that I have ever been or visited. I haven't visited the northwestern region of the country, which is the Chaco, the Great Plains area there, where there's a lot more wildlife. I have not been up there. And the book mentions jaguars. You know, an early version of the book had a different title. I had called it Valleys Full of Jaguars, because I meant that ironically, because I hadn't ever seen one, and not really that, you know, they're not around that much. But a dear friend read the book and said, Diego, you need to change the title. There are no jaguars in your book. That was an earlier version. Now, where the jaguar does pop up is pretty, there's really only a few places, but I use the jaguar as sort of a symbol or a mechanism for talking about these larger questions of identity and belonging and place and so forth.
And why did you choose the jaguar to stand in for that?
Yeah. So if I'm being honest, the more profound, deeper reasons came later, which I am learning, you know, this is my first book, I'm still learning, is part of the process. I started honestly because, number one, jaguars are cool, and number two, they're cool, and number two, the word visually is very, very visually appealing to me. I only learned later the title poem after I abandoned Valleys Full of Jaguars. I decided I needed a new title and a title poem to go along with it. And so the first poem in the book is called Yawarwate White. And only in writing that poem, which I wrote only a couple years ago, I learned that, yes, the jaguar, in fact, does have really crucial significance in Guarani mythology and cosmology. And that poem touches on it a little bit, but they're really these symbols of life and death and connecting with the ancestors and kind of everything in some ways. And so it felt really potent to me to choose a symbol, this animal, that can be kind of both at once, where it is so important, it's almost of monolithic importance in the cosmology. And yet I had literally never encountered that. I had never seen a jaguar in Paraguay. And so some way to try to navigate both of those things at the same time felt really true.
Wow. And it kind of happened accidentally.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. The poems in this book were written over a period of how many years?
Yeah. Well, funny you ask. I did find a draft of one of the poems, The Skin, from like 2008. And so, however many years that is, that's a while, 12, 15, a long time, for quite some time. But most of the poems really shaped up. I want to say I had a version of the book together around 2017 or so. I had a different friend look at it and make some very radical suggestions that I appreciated and adhered to. At that point, it was kind of this odd amalgam of poems I had written in grad school for my thesis and then poems that were more recent. And I was just talking with someone else about this. Oh, it was earlier in class today. I was talking about the need to recognize when you've done a thing, if you've written something, in this case, it was like a paragraph. Maybe the paragraph is good. Maybe it's well written. Maybe you like what it says, but it just doesn't go with the rest of what you have in the paper. Same thing applies.
Yeah, it's what they say. You have to throw out you have to get rid of your babies or kill your darlings. That's what it is. Yes. Kill your darlings. Right. Yes. Yes.
There's a lot of that. There's a slaughter.
So, how you mentioned the book is in three parts. And what are those parts and what do they mean?
Yep. So part of the project of the book, if that doesn't sound too didactic, part of the project of the book is to reenact a process of language acquisition that is fraught or difficult or incomplete or contradictory, such as the one that I have experienced in myself as a poet, but also as the speakers of the poems. And so there's three different sections are just titled after the Guarani words for 1, 2, and 3. So they're just numbered. But those numbers reoccur a couple times. There's a poem where some school children are kind of doing their counting for a volunteer. And then there's another poem where there's a series of kind of joke poems that include the numbering, the numeration as well. And so in some ways, I guess like a side project or like a, not the most important thing, but it would be interesting to me if readers are able to kind of encounter these words over and over again, draw those connections and realize that they are also, in fact, learning Guarani as they read the book.
Okay. So how do you pronounce one in Guarani?
So this is the challenging thing is because I have to refer back to my own Diablo context. And I've asked, and this is kind of part of it though, right? Like,
yes,
this is part of the challenge and the heartbreak, but also the potential. I've asked my dad many times, and he's very gracious, and he will repeat it, and I'm going to have to call him again to ask, but I'm not going to call a friend right now. So,
okay.
Yep. So 1, 2, and 3, Petei, Mokoi, and Bohapu is my best. I would be willing to bet that Guarani speakers would more or less know what I was saying at that
point. Okay, that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
When we're talking about the history of Paraguay and something that kind of there is woven through this book too, there's references to Nazis. Now, you don't say Nazis, but I'm guessing that some of the Nazis, we know that they fled to South America. We know that they ended up in Argentina. Were there communities that ended up in Paraguay?
Oh, yeah. And that's a really unavoidable legacy that I felt it would have been a disservice the book is interested in sort of incompletion, but that's there. That's real. You know, the two examples. One is Nietzsche's sister moved to Paraguay to establish an Aryan colony and quickly abandon it. But it's around. I name it in the book Nueva Germania. So, New Germany is a real thing. It's a place. It's where a bunch of German descended people descended from actual Nazis. And also Mengele, the angel of death, lived in Paraguay for a while. And that on its own, it's troubling, it's upsetting, it's frightening, but it also speaks to some larger concerns that my mom is white. She was born in Pennsylvania in this country, and we don't really have German ancestry, but there was something odd every time I sat down to think about that dynamic that I couldn't separate out. My own whiteness and legacies of whiteness and the oppressive histories in this country and globally, but also then in Paraguay. So what does that look like? And it just felt so close, and yet there's this parallax I rely on, but like so close, because these colonies, these little towns, they're right there in that part of Paraguay, not terribly far from where my dad grew up. And yet so far, right, because we had never been to them. I didn't hear about this growing up. I learned about it later from the internet, from Wikipedia. And it felt like something I wanted to gesture toward later in the book, to try to kind of tie those threads together in some way.
And I felt like there was a poem early in the book where I got the impression, and maybe you come up right out and say that your wife is Jewish.
Mm-hmm, yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's a certain amount of anti-Semitism even among your relatives in Paraguay.
Yeah. There's all over the country for sure. But there was just that one of the poems, Punchline, which was one of the last poems I wrote. Actually, I have in my office right now, I have the printed pages that I did my final edits right before I sent it to the press. And that was one of the last poems I wrote. The story there comes from an actual instance at a dinner where my tío was telling a story, and you could tell it was a joke because the way he kind of his face lit up and he was going to tell a joke. But I could tell from what he was saying, I couldn't totally follow the joke because jokes are notoriously hard to translate. Like, they rely on a lot of inference and, you know, expression and emphasis. And so, but I did catch that it was going to be a joke about Jewish people. What I didn't catch was the end. And this is captured in the poem. But when he gave the punchline, I didn't react because I didn't understand it. My dad didn't translate it either because he was uncomfortable, or he didn't get it either, or he thought the moment would pass because it was awkward or something. But like, I never got that resolution. And it was just a snapshot into, I don't think it's unique to Paraguay, but the sort of the casual anti-Semitism that exists and, you know, continues to, and that certainly informs, it has to be a part of my considerations for what that means for my family and my child, our loved ones and friends. And
Right. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Diego Baez, the author of Yawarate White. Would you like to read a few poems from the book for us?
Yes, I would love that. I've been thinking about which poems to read, and there's for sure I want to read one from early in the book, and it's called Regalito. It's about language acquisition, so much of what we've been talking about today. And then so I'd like to read that one. And then I might like to pair that one with a poem later in the book that sort of addresses slightly different topics. So
okay.
This poem is called Regalito. Sometimes I like to preface poems with any context you might need, but I think this one includes everything that you might need to make sense of it. So it's called Regalito. Some immigrants stuff language into duffel bags like contraband. Other children never learn to handle the baggage of their claim. When I ask my father why he didn't teach us Spanish, he says he tried, but that my brothers and I always squirmed and whined. I do remember dreading the militant insistence my father placed on our calls, our response to his calls. Si, papi, he'd have us parrot. Which I guess is a question, or maybe an affirmation. Like maybe finding the breathless body of his infant brother when he was 5 broke him. So maybe the sound of our voices singing our inheritance, this tongue of ours, grants a succession of his name, our house. But I do remember asking my father more than once how to say something stupid in Spanish like toaster or roller coaster. From the driver's seat of that minivan, I'm sure of it, he answered, "There's not a word for that."
Now, before you go on to the next one, what does regalito mean?
Regalito means like a little gift. And that is based in fact. You know, poetry, we poets, we like to blur the line between fact and fiction. the facts of that poem are that my father did discover his newborn brother who had died kind of in between the crib and the wall, and I think about that a lot, obviously, now as a father. But I also think about what impact that must have had when his own children came into the world. And this thought of both wanting to give your children the world, give them everything, but then also, for whatever reasons, being unable or unwilling to share parts of ourselves. And it's something that I'm really facing now, of course, with a child myself. So I think I'd like to read this poem. A friend very kindly screenshot this poem on Facebook recently, and I was reminded how much I enjoyed it myself. I haven't really thought about it. But interestingly, this poem does take up the character of the Tio, the uncle, that we were talking about earlier. He features in just a couple of these poems. And one thing I do in the book almost unconsciously is switch between using English words for relatives and Spanish words. And I didn't realize that until I went back, you know, several edits of the manuscript and to kind of flag that. And I the best I can figure is that at certain points, the speaker is speaking to himself or his own family or close relations. And in that voice, it's much more familial, so we use the Spanish. And there's other poems, though, where the speaker is trying to relate some kind of an experience that feels distant or closed off, or we're talking to a different audience. And so in this poem called Americano, occurs a little bit later in the book, you'll hear the speaker uses the word uncle. And so this is he's speaking to an English-speaking audience. And I think the only other thing you need to know is that I didn't know this at first, of course, but I learned from my uncle that in Paraguay, they will often refer to Spanish, so this, you know, Espanol, Spanish language, as Castellano, which these are the kind of things I wish they taught us in grade school and in middle school, in high school, whatever, is that people in different countries refer to languages differently, right? And so it's common knowledge in Paraguay, you refer to Castellano, you're talking about Spanish, but I had literally never heard that because that's not the Spanish I was taught growing up from my father or from the schools. And so this poem relies a little bit, or I guess, yeah, it relies on sort of the interplay between Americano and Castellano, and again, actually a joke that doesn't quite translate. and so this poem is called Americano. It's a prose poem. My oddest Paraguayan uncle speaks no English and has done very well for himself. Big house, football pitch, spirals of barbed wire, psychotic German shepherds. He calls me Americano like he's ordering cafe. I call him Castellano, but he doesn't get the joke. I struggle to translate, and helpers serve a tray of biscuits, tea, guava, and margarine. I have no idea what my uncle does for a living. Coffee or cane sugar, plantations of elder bark way out in Los Campos. He has amassed more property, objects, and animals than the rest of the neighborhood combined. He has bulldozed adjacent lots to expand this private empire. He has made the most of his time. Never mind the unpeopled rooms and halls, mis primos off to study elsewhere in the world, boxes of clothing and toys stacked along the walls. His wife works long hours at the hospital and is never around. The house staff leaves at 8 in the evening, so the night before I fly home, we toast this country's history. We drink to the memory of anonymous men long gone. We kill the bottle. I don't remember the rest. He drives me to the airport in the morning, both of us still painfully hungover. Hints of night vomit occupy the space between us. Then, like two longtime friends who will no doubt reconnect, he drops me off without ceremony, saying only, ciao, Americano. As if it were another time, a different place. As if that were the end of it.
And that was Diego Baez reading from Yawarate White, that poem called Americano. You know, it's interesting that you talked about how you refer to cousins as, and, you know, tio or uncles, T-O-T. And the, because when I was reading, one of the words that jumped out at me was primo. I could tell from the context that it made cousin, that it meant cousin, although I checked. T-O-T-I, I know some, you know, hermano. I know a little bit of Spanish, but that wasn't one I had ever, that I remembered from my, you know, high school Spanish. And it struck me because primo, P-R-I-M-O, you'd think it might be related to prime. So why is that the Spanish word for cousin? So I had this curiosity about the etymology of the word. Do you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I do remember a conversation early on about, I don't remember which poem it was, but using the word primo to describe both, well, actually to describe my brothers and I from my primo's perspective. So we were the primos Americanos. And I went back and forth with an editor about the word order, because conventionally in Spanish, the adjectives come after the nouns, not always, but oftentimes. And that's just something that we don't really do in English at all. And so it felt like such a silly quibble. Like, we're literally talking about two words here. Are we going to call them the Americano primos or the primos Americanos? Going back and forth and back and forth. Those are the kinds of questions that, and what, like, did, etymology.
And where did so you end up?
Primos Americanos.
Primos Americanos. Yeah. That makes sense. You know, another word. Now, this is probably a Guarani word. Yuyos. So what is that?
Yeah. So the yuyos are herbs, plants used by a yuyera, which is like a, you know, it's funny. Our best cognates are potentially not derogatory, but have connotations. But so like witch doctor or like country doctor or like traditional healer, those kinds of things. So a yuyera would, you know, select whatever herbs they have around and to make a tea or make a poultice or some kind of mendicant. And I knew I wanted to do so. Speaking of etymology, I wanted to do something with this idea of, like, etymology is so fascinating to me because they're like these little pieces that exist in all the words we use that are thousands of years old, which is wild. And so I found three words. There actually is kind of, there's proportionally a lot of Guarani words have made it into English language. So toucan, jaguar. But then I did find a few others that just so happened to describe things that could be considered like ingredients in a recipe or what have you. And so I did write a super short poem about those yuyos. And I wanted to think about the yuyos as like both the etymological nuggets, but also the healing properties that perhaps a language provides.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Now, you know, talking about the, like, kind of the form of the book and the form of poems that you use in the book, there's a lot of variety, a lot of variation. So you have prose poems, you have short poems, you have long poems, you have poems that where the placement of the word on the page is part of the poem. I know there's a word for that. I don't remember what it is. Just talk about that a little bit. First of all, why you go so, you know, you're not just writing sonnets, you're writing just about every form of poetry that exists, and how you then decide what form does this poem What does it belong to?
Yeah, that is such a good question, and I could very easily talk for an hour. Maybe I should. Maybe I need to run away from it. But briefly, I'll just say that the prose poems started from experiences that either felt closed off or separate from me, or that needed some kind of very recognizable container. So just a block, like a block of text. And I wanted to unburden myself from line breaks and scansion, and even though some of that you have to apply in the prose poems as well. In the beginning of the book, some of those prose poems start to decompose. They start to break apart. And when the prose poems start to decompose, I wanted to move intentionally and then into the line, the lyric. And I love couplets. They're easy, I think. It's convenient. But I really love tercets. I love a tidy tercet where you got these three lines that can just kind of, these three nuggets gonna pop, pop, pop. I also am very interested in, and that's not the right word for it. I am attracted to asymmetries. And so I really like when, I love poets who give their poems these long, ridiculous titles, and then the poem's like two lines long. I love that. It's funny, I think it's effective. And so there's some of that in here. The table of contents is really jagged. It's really uneven, which I very much like about the book. I love a good short poem. I prefer short poems, but I wanted to try to challenge myself to write at least a couple of poems that were more than one page. That's my like Achilles. I have a hard time writing a poem that's more than one page. And so I really had to extend myself for those. But I also think that it's a result of just the time frame. You know, if I had composed the poems in this book over a shorter period of time, I imagine they'd be more similar. And so on the one hand, that's maybe an advantage to taking a long time to write a book, while there are certainly other drawbacks.
That's true. How did you decide what poems? I'm sure you wrote more poems during this time period. How did you decide which ones made it into the book?
Yep. Towards the later stages of really what is behind me, what you can see behind me, and listeners can imagine, it's just a bunch of pages taped to the wall. That was really the last opportunity of culling the poems that I like them. They're good poems. They just don't fit in the book, and that's hard. Some of those were actually, most of those were more. There were more abstract reflections or games with language. And I feel like there's enough of that in the book anyway, so those kind of had to go. There was a poem about Central Illinois that I also kind of let go because, again, it was a little more abstract. It didn't really have any of the characters who are in the book now. And there's enough of Central Illinois in the book as well. and then it really was a process of finding those two or three opportunities. There weren't many, but two or three opportunities to add new poems. And of course, I think every poet goes through this. There are poems that I either wanted to write or couldn't get together in time or whatever. And certainly this is not all I'll write about Paraguay. I did have one poem in particular about, I live up here in Chicago. I used to live in the Uptown neighborhood near Graceland Cemetery, which is a historic cemetery here in Chicago. It used to be the edge of town, which is why it's a cemetery. There's a cemetery there. Anyways, it's got this beautiful architecture and this landscaping, but also has incredible wildlife. There's coyotes that live there and deer and hawks and all this. It's all this wild stuff in the middle of town here. And wow. I was really, it's incredible. I loved living there. But one night, the train, the L train, is not far from there. And it, during that particular part of the tracks, it would squeak and screech a lot. And it almost sounded like coyote howls or yips. And it struck me as a quintessentially Chicago experience to be hearing the train going overhead, like, you know, half a mile down, and confusing it for the coyotes that live across the state. but that's an example of one that, like, I really like that poem. It's one of the more recent ones I've written. It's about Chicago, but it doesn't fit. It didn't make the cut. So.
Oh. So is there a start on the next book?
So it's very interesting you say that. So I have used this opportunity to try to motivate myself to write whatever the next book might be in a shorter time frame. Mm-hmm. I do have a lot more I want to explore with regard to Paraguay. but also other parts of my heritage, specifically my mom's side. And so there's kind of two aspects of that. I'm interested in these women artists from Paraguay, these visual artists from Paraguay who work in fabric arts and do a lot of, there's a traditional, I suppose, it's a traditional lace work in Paraguay called ñanduti, which is a Guarani word that means spider's web. And I should have examples in my office, but I don't. And they do this incredible kind of contemporary takes on that, which is, it's like sculpture through lace work, which is incredible. I'm interested in writing some ekphrastic poems inspired by that artwork. I'm also interested in exploring some strange coincidences. So my mom's, I guess this is in the book a little bit, but my mom's family name is Lynch, which, you know, it's a bit of a freighted word. And interestingly, one of the dictators of Paraguay, I suppose, took an Irish woman to join him, and her name was Eliza Lynch, and she joined Francisco Lopez in Paraguay as, they never got married, but as his like partner, courtesan, or however you want to say, and she had outsized influence. She had a great influence on the country and on Lopez's decision making. And they're mentioned a little bit in this book, but I just feel like there's a lot more to say there. That's a wild coincidence.
Wow, that is something. Wow. So we only have a few minutes, but I do want to mention also another thing in the book. You have these repeated postcards from your semester abroad, volunteer trip, and mission visit. Can you explain those to us a little bit?
Yes, for sure. So those began from two places. The first was my own observations in Paraguay. So when we would fly down, I mentioned it, we would always visit in the middle of winter from where we were coming, and it would be summer there. So when we visited, we were pasty, you know, our skin was pasty white, we were light skinned, and we'd go and just, we'd really stand out, as obviously we were visiting from somewhere else, but also we kind of looked like everybody else there, you know? And so that was always a funny dynamic. And of course, by the end of our time there, I don't know what the sunscreen protocols were, maybe a little more lax then than they are now, but you would be super tan by the time we left. And so I would notice anybody else who stood out as not being from Paraguay. And you'd notice, or I would notice, the Mormons or the missionaries or the volunteers. And that much, you know, many, many years later, prompted me to do some Google searching. This would have been really, I did most of the, I'm using air quotes for research, the Googling in 2010 or so, you know, 2010, 2011, finding other accounts online of people who had done similar things. So people who had volunteered for the Peace Corps, who had gone with their church or were there to do good or whatever. And there was a really disturbing trend amongst these blog posts. They were, you know, the best of them were of the white savior variety. Like, I'm trying to help these people, but they don't want to be helped. The worst of them were, I mean, some of it kind of makes it into the book. They were just really dismissive and condescending. And so I really started with actual blog posts. And that's why I do include a note borrowed from blog. That's not just a note. That's not a creative choice. I mean, I actually did take this from other people as sort of a found text poem that I then editorialized over several different rounds. And I relied on some keen readers to help me shape those. Cause in whatever early version of those poems, it was just copy and paste of these blog posts. And that doesn't really work as poetry.
Right. Yeah.
I fixed those up, changed them up. And somebody else recently commented and said that they're both frustrating and funny. And I think that that's right.
Yes.
Cause it's very much like, how can that be your cave? How is that your opinion?
Yeah.
Laugh, right?
So. Right. Well, Diego, we're out of time. It's amazing how quickly an hour can pass. And we always end with the quote. And when I was looking for quotes by Paraguayan authors, I don't know this author. I hope maybe you do. Augusto Roa Bastos.
Yeah.
And one thing he wrote, what happens is that your wretched memory remembers the words and forgets what's behind them.
Wow. I had not I heard that quote before. That's great.
I thought it great worked time. For today.
Yes, totally.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Monica.
And see you all next week.